Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Ken Pai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So in today's episode, I talked to May Abdallah, who with Anagram, they produced a piece called Impulse, Playing with Reality, which is a part of their larger Playing with Reality series, which is looking at different mental health conditions and giving you like an embodied experience of them. This piece with Impulse was around ADHD, which premiered back in 2024, and then went on to win the top prize at Venice. It's a really amazing experience. If you haven't had a chance to see it, highly recommend going to check it out. So Agong went to them to see if they wanted to do a research study to see how can they start to quantify the different types of behavioral changes that may come about after someone sees Impulse playing with reality? So they did a whole study with over 100 people, and that report just came out this past week called Results of an Impact Study Carried Out for Mixed Reality Experience Impulse Digest for General Public. Came out on March 28th, 2026, and then I had a conversation the night before it came out, and then that following weekend, I actually gave a keynote talk at the Meaningful XR conference where I was starting to synthesize some of the different ways of how I'm taking a bit of a phenomenological approach for starting to think about how do you measure the different types of impact on these different experiences. And so I'll be airing that keynote in the next episode. But in this conversation, we're just wrestling through what's it mean as an artist to start to have your work quantified in this way, and how does it actually change the production of the experiences? For May, she's still really focused on telling the best story that she possibly can of really trying to create this emotional valence and just experience and creating embodiment to use the affordances of XR to just tell the story in the best way that she knows how as a documentary filmmaker. And so there's this other subsequent aspect, which is the impact campaign that usually comes after, in terms of like connecting directly to different contexts, whether it's in education or in work context. And so ways that you can start to bring an experience like this to bring more awareness around these issues around neurodiversity. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with May happened on Wednesday, May 27th, 2026. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
My name's May Abdallah, and for the past 12 or so years, I've been running a studio called Anagram, which is based in the UK, but now based in a few other places as everything becomes more remote. And I guess Anagram's USP or obsession is really creating immersive experiences, which range across different kinds of technologies that take you into some kind of embodied story where what you do is significant for what we're kind of exploring in the subject matter. And kind of the drive for that is around some kind of change to occur. And often the subjects we explore, things that are difficult things to talk about or might be divisive in some way, and kind of, let's say, other kind of formats for kind of cracking open that subject matter have their own issues or can only take us so far. So there's, you know, over the years, it's kind of felt like there's been a real, you know, proof in the pudding of what immersive or embodied or first person or interactive stuff where you really are part of something kind of cuts across some other like emotional and cognitive discourse. So that's Anagram. We've been working on a series of projects called Playing with Reality, which started off with Goliath in 2020, which is a 25-minute virtual reality story about a man who was diagnosed with schizophrenia and then discovered online gaming. And it won a Lion at Venice and got nominated for an Emmy. And since kind of being on the store, I mean, I think it got 700,000 downloads within the first 2 months. And it was a real kind of like, oh, okay, there's indie, the indie weird fringe scene that this thing has got an audience and huge amounts of engagement just in kind of like, what does it mean to use virtual reality to talk about mental health and what that feels like? And so that actually kind of encouraged us to look at that series of works kind of more broadly and not just think about schizophrenia, but think about ADHD, which was the follow-up to that mixed reality experience called Impulse, and the project that we're doing at the moment, which is about body image, called Amorphous. So yeah, that's the context.
Perfect. Well, I've long been a fan of Anagram's work since I first saw Collider back at IFA Doc Lab 2018, when I happened to do a less than 24 hours pit stop into Amsterdam and happened to make it to Doc Lab. And so I've really loved the work that you've done over the years. And it does have this sort of transformative feel where you do want to make an impact on people. And just did an interview with Joe Pine about the transformation economy. And, you know, also this whole IFA Doc Lab report that I did, where the whole thrust of it was like, what are we doing with this XR medium? Is it making impact? Is it actually making change? And so there is this whole subsection of XR for good, meaningful XR, where there does explicitly try to be using XR to do pro-social change. And so you have to have some model of change of where things are at. And then how do you measure that from the beginning to the end? I see Anagram as a bit of an artist that are driven by the artistic process of how to best tell the story in an immersive way. And I feel like as I read some of these impact report, the results of the impact study carried out for mixed reality experience of Impulse, it's a digest for general public. This is a report that's going to be coming out here tomorrow as when we're recording this. So the first question I have is, when you start to do some of these, did you have a sense of how you would maybe start to quantify some of that change? Or would you say that Anagram is more driven by this unconscious artistic process where you're just kind of following what is the most compelling for you to tell the story? And then from there, try to figure out, okay, how do we actually put this in the world and try to quantify what this is actually doing to the wider world?
Yeah, that's the question we're probably going to unpack over the next hour. So the context was that, you know, Agog, which I'm sure most people have heard of by now, but, you know, they are really out there in the world supporting XR for social impact. It was like a year after Impulse came out that they talked to us about running a study. There was due to be like a 6-week long showing at the Undershed in Bristol, which, you know, would have 1,000 or so people go through the experience. And it felt like, well, you know, it's really great to run those things alongside like an actual public, because a lot of the logistics of thinking about making a report and doing these kinds of studies when they're driven by academia. We'd been in conversations with people for a long time about doing stuff like this. We did do a study specifically with nurses, trainee nurses, who were using Goliath as part of their education process. And then we also did some work with an architecture firm in London called Foster and Partners, where they were exploring using Impulse to support their internal staff, like reflection on ADHD and improving processes. So like, yeah, no, of course, like, there's a definite clash in a way between artistic process and these kind of quantifiable tick box kind of outcomes that these reports kind of need to offer, or the promise of these reports. And, you know, I've always had a bit of an internal tension about, you know, what if a piece of art doesn't change something immediately in the world? Would you say that that isn't worth existing? How would you ever like quantify what change is? But then I didn't design the study. We worked with an absolutely incredible professor called Alexander Sierra, based in the Netherlands, who, as you can see from the report, you know, is a maths brain. And really, like, what does it mean to have statistical significance? What are the necessary requirements, the gender balance requirements, the age balance requirements? And, you know, I knew that we wanted to have rigor. And that's, of course, Agog also wanted that, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff that reads a little bit like a PR campaign for it. And of course, it does often depend who funds the stuff and, you know, when it's kind of, attached to a private organization that have an interest in telling you that if you use VR to train your baristas to make coffee, they will forever make coffee in their sleep. So there's that kind of tension that I think I personally had thinking about what does an impact study look like. But by that time, like, Impulse had been out for a year, and, you know, it was different. But in a way, Impulse is really interesting because Goliath was about the experience of what schizophrenia does to someone's life, both as a medical condition, but also really thinking about the construct, you know, within which people have that experience and the politics and systemic social reality of what it means to be isolated and excluded. But ADHD is a much, to quote a kind of TV exec, it's a much crunchier topic. It's very close to a lot of people. And I think it was interesting for me as somebody who'd worked in documentaries for a long time. And, increasingly I've been thinking of the work that, if you think about like this kind of age-old idea about like empathy machine, this idea of the other and like having a relationship with the other and thinking about the other, that now I'm kind of thinking a lot about how there's something almost prosaic about ADHD. It's so kind of close as to be uninteresting, but it's an incredibly divisive topic. And I can get into like what's actually divisive about it. That by that time, I'd seen a lot of amazing feedback and kind of anecdotal stuff. And I was really interested to genuinely, the question was, look, let's do a study that's about actual behavioral change and not about attitude shift, because we've all seen the attitude shift. And there are a couple of things about the study which are really incredible, which is obviously the sample size, which I'll go into, is brilliant. And then the groups that specifically Alex defined in order to be able to make it representative of what wider society looks like. And then a lot of the earlier studies, you'd get people who hadn't done much VR before. And then because of the nature of the people we were working with or all of that, you're not getting that I've never done VR before kind of shock factor, because I think it's like 8% use it frequently and 63% have used it before. So it's kind of interesting that some of those layers that I think it's easy to feel a little bit cynical about are taken out of the equation. And so, yeah, I didn't initially kind of have this resistance, but I also just wanted to genuinely know. And it was such a great opportunity. The other thing about this data, so I'll go through the analysis that we've kind of presented in this report, but we really threw loads of questions into the wider. So it was 118 people across three groups. So there were people with direct experience, like a diagnosis or a presumed kind of self-diagnosis of ADHD as group one, people with a family member or a partner with ADHD, and then people with no relationship to ADHD. And the key thing is that there's a questionnaire that they kind of go through with a researcher before, directly after, and then kind of 1 month plus. And the 1 month plus is really looking at kind of habits and behavior change that has happened in their lives at that point. So one of the things that, I really wanted to see what actually happens. But then I think what I've become more interested is like, there's more there than just did it work or not. There's a nuance in what happens and what doesn't happen, which kind of talks a little bit more about what's the process of change, what change meets resistance and what change doesn't meet resistance. And I think actually, I also think there's an opportunity for other researchers to use the data and kind of come to different kind of, come at it in different ways. And then there's also stuff about kind of stigma. And I think there's an increasing interest, there's increasing kind of texture in the field about what stigma really means or what change means. So I really want to kind of dig into that with you. So, yeah, I'd say that I'm still 100% a believer that this is not, there's a kind of, I've always felt a little bit ickiness, I think, to trying to prove change, partly because that's not what I think artwork does. But then I think that trying to grapple with some of the detail in this report has made me think more about the discomfort of change and why I think my process as an artist and working with Barry, and what does storytelling mean and what are structures of feeling and all of that stuff is about kind of creating a case whereby somebody can go into actually a difficult feeling and kind of come through the other side. So there's stuff there which I think tells us about art as well as just a tick box exercise in terms of like, a pleasing top line that says 56 of people who did this, then went on to, seek care from a counselor or a GP, which is a great top line for the report. And it does say that something happened, but there's so much more in there that I think is worth exploring, especially with someone like you,
Yeah, no.
for whom that's like, it's real material to think with.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is one of the most meaty studies I've seen so far that anyone's done of impact. Because a lot of the studies I'd seen before was like, oh, they'll take the same content, they'll put it in VR, and then they'll make the video version. And it's more of a analysis across like different media. But I think just by kind of forgetting that and say, hey, we're going to make this piece of art, it's immersive. Does it actually change behavioral change like over time, which is like a longitudinal study, which is one of the things that Joseph Pine says is that like transformation is something that is lasting change that sustains itself over time rather than something that may have an experience and it's memorable, but it's different than having something that transformative change. And so there's lots of stuff to dig into, and I'm excited to start to unpack different aspects. I think one top line thing that I saw as I was going through is that there's this page that just has this graphic that says 1 month after doing Impulse, over half the people who suspected they had ADHD symptoms had either seen a doctor or spoken to a counselor. So yeah, that is huge, because that is sort of like, you know, the piece itself, I highly recommend folks go check it out. But it's something that I remember in my own body. And since I've seen it twice, like the first kind of iteration and then the full version of it.
Yeah.
So I saw a couple of previous iterations of it. And there's still things that I take away from seeing that experience, because, you know, I have family members who may or may not have it, who suspect they probably have it, and other extended family that has definitely been diagnosed with it. So after I saw it, it's also changed my own perception of them. But also, it just was really fascinating to see like kind of a wide spectrum of oral history testimonies of the wide variety of different expressions of ADHD that people may have. And that, you know, there's not going to be a singular instantiation of what it looks like. It's more of an archetypal complex that you have to know the possibility space of different ways that it could show up in someone's life. And so to see some of those examples of that and to see how that could map over to the people that I knew is something that has really stuck with me. So I know from my own personal experience, aside from all the numbers and everything else, I know that this is a piece that can have some transformative potential. So then the question is how to start to define that change. What is from the beginning, what the end? And as I look through this paper, I'm really seeing like you're really focusing on what I see as this kind of elemental approach of like either you're getting knowledge and information, or like you're learning about it, or you're relating to other people. So you're connecting to other people in a social fashion. Either you're actually creating a safe space for people to kind of discuss it so that there's a safe context for people to be in, so that you're in a situation of relatedness to start to talk about it. And then there's the empathy of being able to kind of identify with other people and either provide effective empathy, or there's cognitive empathy where you just have a deeper level of understanding. And then there's like different aspects of the actual habit changes, which I think is kind of the crux of what you're going for, which is like, how are people actually changing their behaviors? So I have my own kind of experiential design framework that I'm like mapping onto this. And the study isn't necessarily presenting that information in these kind of neat categories that I just laid out, but I feel like it's all there in terms of the different things that you're pointing at. So I don't know if you have any comments so far.
I think the thing that I appreciated that Alexandra brought to the table was really separating these two kinds of empathy, affective and cognitive empathy, and really thinking about what does that mean in terms of knowledge and embodied knowledge. So I think we can get into what that means, but effectively it means you can see what kind of empathy somebody might have experienced from the piece, and whether or not that's the kind of empathy that leads to change or not, you know. And the thing that as I point, like, maybe just a little bit context about ADHD and kind of why I do think it's a sticky topic, because to some degree, you know, and you can see that maybe more in group three, where you're talking about people who have no connection or no real, you know, direct lived experience of ADHD through friends or family. The reality is that people's experience of people with ADHD is often negative for a number of reasons. You know, this is why even doing an empirical study is kind of counterintuitive. You know, there are just structures in modern life whereby productivity and particular kinds of timekeeping and things which naturally ADHD will make it obvious that you're not kind of predisposed to, like these things, you know, there are elements that ADHD is a disorder, partly because it cuts against what normative culture requires of an individual in order to get from A to B in a life. And so within the language where, as a culture, we have our values, we know what's right, we know what's worthwhile, we know which people are good, we have our own moral kind of language around experience. And it's no coincidence the first ever known description of ADHD, which I think is in 1912. I hope this is right. I've got it in a different document. Was seen as a disorder of morality. Okay, so and it's interesting because then you see all the different words that are used to define ADHD between then and now. And what I think is interesting about looking at mental health is because it's where we have an interesting tension as a culture where we love to give experts kind of power over what is right and wrong. And yet, if you look at the DCM-5, which is the present kind of definitive dictionary of diagnosable mental health conditions and kind of how that has evolved since the first one, it's also obvious that it's societal construct as well as a empirical neurological reality. So you've got, and what I'm saying is it sounds like it's contradicting each other, but it's just the crunch of where ADHD kind of sits. So it was important for us that we didn't just tell a story that was about here's how difficult it is to have ADHD, which is part of what Impulse does through the first person storytelling and giving you some moments of the adrenaline coursing through your body and dissatisfaction and things. So you have that momentary somatic experience. But it's also about how difficult it is to have ADHD if you're in a particular sector of society in this world as it is now. And so that's where I thought the kind of delineation between the two kinds of empathy and what caused change, right? So you needed to have both the cognitive empathy and the affective empathy in order to bring about change behavior. And I think that the cognitive empathy really comes from that bigger narrative around what causes the struggle, what the individuals with ADHD are trying to fit into and why there's a tension between how their impulsivity or determination or whatever it is that kind of features in each person's story, that as well as the fact that, yeah, those two things lead to that understanding. And what's interesting is obviously, and I know you've talked about this before, in this particular community, we don't have to kind of beat that drum over and over again and say, try and convince people that VR is powerful. We know that VR is powerful. In fact, perhaps we need to be cautious about giving people these really dramatic experiences. And I'm sure you're aware of the case of some school children in Poland last year getting PTSD through watching some like curriculum-based experience about Nazi Germany. So, I'm not trying to swing through the other side and I want to have a that conversation. And so there's kind of me as the artist and me as the documentary maker and a document and I do feel very happy living inside the paradigm of a documentary filmmaker, even though I don't really ever pick up a camera anymore. And I've definitely not edited in Premiere since 2005. But the paradigm of a documentary maker is a lot about duty of care towards your audience and taking you somewhere, like almost the responsibility of a happy ending is I can imagine there would be panels about that. And so because you're trying to balance that, how effective can something be? How much can I give you that feeling of overwhelm? It's relevant at least. We know that VR can give you a feeling of overwhelm without even having to think twice about it. At least it's relevant in a piece about ADHD that we're doing that. But how not to I don't know, not to kind of leave you in a state of emotional fragility because of that, and give you the tools to see what's productive with that experience. So even, yeah, like there was a report done in the Daily Telegraph, which is a paper in the UK that's, kind of considered to be quite conservative and a bit skeptical around these kind of narratives around neurodiversity and the requirements of individuals. And it was incredible reading the journalist's response to that, which was very much around her sense of fear and panic within the experience at points, and then being able to, I don't know, be taken somewhere constructive to see that that wasn't just about trying to scare her and make her feel, but that it was actually something that would be an ordinary emotional reaction for somebody with ADHD.
And you're so this article was writing about Impulse.
So it was it came out when it a year or so ago.
Yeah, so there's lots of different threads that we can start to go down and unpack different aspects of this. The first thing I want to ask is around these groups, because I think that, in the group three, where they have basically no prior experience, maybe like high stigma around people with ADHD. And then the second group is people who have some family member, friends or family that they know that have it. And then the top group is people that have either been actually diagnosed or suspected that they might have a diagnosis. And the process of getting diagnosis is a journey within its own self. So, and like people can suspect that they have it without really knowing for sure, which is a part of the whole weird gaslighting thing that can happen with ADHD. Some people may have even tried to get validated they have it and then get denied a diagnosis, which is a whole other aspect to this thing. But those three groups, people who either have direct experience or they know they have it or suspect they have it, people who have friends and family, and then the third group. And so I guess in determining change, people already have it. They already probably know all about it because they live with it, but they can still have some change, but may not be as big as people have no connection to anybody with it and don't have it at all. And so you have these ways that you can see relative change relative to those groups based upon their prior knowledge and what their context coming into the situation. And so as you were starting to develop this, was that something that maybe just kind of talk around that process of kind of splitting up this research group into these three different distinct cohorts that you could start to compare to each other?
So that came through we were working with Professor Alexandra Sierra and also Dr. Sandra Gaudenzi at UCL. We did actually a massive literature review to see what was already out there, what were the holes really as well. But then we also had to think about what we thought anecdotally, what we'd seen happening, or us as artists, why we made the project and what we believed we were making it for. And I think I'd always understood that whereas with Goliath, I hadn't assumed that the piece really was for people with schizophrenia, thinking about their own experience, although after it came out, that actually became its own subgroup for people who wanted to show it to other people, to communicate and that kind of. But I did already have a strong hunch that people with ADHD were going to, in some way, benefit from seeing their story told in this particular way. And it really hinges on how the moment of diagnosis gives each of the characters in the story a moment where they look back at their lives and the voice of their assumption that everything they did was a failure is seen through a different lens. And it's not necessarily about getting them off the hook or any of those things, but it's more like what happens when you can see your life and you can see the patterns in your life, which obviously doesn't relate just to ADHD. It relates to many things that sometimes we can see patterns in our lives, and that helps unlock an approach that doesn't feel like a second-to-second coping strategy. And so I always assumed that there was going to be some benefit for people with ADHD, and in the UK, in some places, the waiting list is 8 years and up, and the
That's
question
just to
is,
get a that's just to get a doctor's
how to
appointment to
get
see if you
diagnosed.
have.
Yeah, and
Wow,
then
8 years
second,
that you're waiting.
and also, but what does that diagnosis really mean? That diagnosis might be redemptive for some people, even if they never choose to use any of the services that come along with that. At the same time, the label of ADHD, like I said, it's kind of had loads of iterations. For the very first interview we did, someone said, "Well, I don't have any attention deficit. If I have anything, I have more attention than anyone else in the room." It's a challenging acronym. It's almost, slightly devoid. So it was, I assumed that there was going to be some benefit for people who were trying to understand. And there was a particular year when we were in development where I don't know if it was just the algorithm, but there was just a lot of lay people trying to explain what ADHD meant to them through words. And it just felt like, well, you know what? It's good at explaining experiences. And then there's the other thing of just the challenge of having someone close in your life with ADHD, which I'm sure anybody who is in that situation understands what that means. And I knew that the outcomes for that group would need to be looked at differently, because that's really around considerations and patience and understanding and how it affects your relationship. And that's a big theme. And then in a way, that other group, it's a necessary group to make the entire study statistically relevant, but then it's interesting to extract information even from that. So the groups are both kind of a way of making the quantitative analysis make sense, as well as allowing us to channel different kinds of outcomes for different groups. So you're thinking about what does it mean in terms of, self-acceptance for group one, patience and care for a family member in group two, and then group three has an interesting journey with stigma.
Nice. And so how do you want to start to unpack these? I mean, as I was reading through this report, I gotta be honest, when I was reading all the numbers, like, oh my God, how do I make sense of heads or tails? And then I started to.
I can help with that because that's kind of, I think we haven't put it out in the world yet. And I think it's, yeah, the, there's a lot of numbers. It's a lot of maths. That's what, because for many reasons, we've got to work within that system of, do a rigorous quantitative data collection model to buy a seat at the table with the policymakers and the funders, because we need to be able to show that baseline, even if in this conversation we can kind of critique that that baseline is something that we have to even discuss. So I think that perhaps there's a few different areas that we can go into, and I think stigma is an interesting one. In a way, the report kind of we think about knowledge and understanding, stigma and behavioral change as kind of three different areas. And in a way, knowledge and understanding, we can kind of leave that till the end because it's worth unpacking, but it's not as, I don't know, it's not as rich as the other two.
Yeah, well, maybe let's start with the stigma, because there's a bit of a stigma where you have the expectations or someone's behavior, you're attributing some sort of moral value or character to someone, but it may be attributed to these external conditions of ADHD that once you understand what that is, then you can lower that stigma because it's less around like blaming the person rather than blaming this larger context or condition that may be beyond their agency to sort of like have full control over how they may be acting or behaving or how that's manifesting in a way that creates that stigma. So maybe just like describe like the con what is the contours of that stigma around ADHD? What's it look like?
So I think there's a few different ways in which people might encounter that stigma. There's stigma with the discourse around ADHD. I thought it was interesting, like whilst we were in development for Impulse, there was a strike by teachers in the UK. And during the kind of local radio phone-ins, you'd hear lots of teachers talk about the pressures that they were under due to the special needs requirements in classes. And you were beginning to see that it was kind of one person's right to talk about difference was kind of being structured as directly opposed to another person's freedom to be able to carry out their job, right? So it could be about so many different things in 2026, but it is one of the themes that are there. And where people feel like they can't express their true opinions because there's something wrong about saying that this is difficult or they don't know how to manage it. So there's the stigma around what expectations of an individual are. And then there's the individual behaviors of somebody with ADHD. And so that kind of section, which is looking at stigma, really kind of looks at both of those areas. And I think what's kind of counterintuitive with this results, and it's kind of worth explaining it. So you mentioned obviously this kind of good headline, which is 50%, more than 50% of people went to go and see a doctor or a counselor within 4 weeks of seeing Impulse. But then there's this kind of, I don't know, if you read it quickly, it seems like a fail, but it was really interesting kind of looking into the detail of what that actually means. But that kind of fail, as it were, is around this kind of spike that happens in stigma after people have done the experience, and what does that mean? And then what happens after 4 weeks, and why does that change? And it's interesting to kind of think of the project, like what is going on in somebody's mind that you have this spike and then it improves somehow, let's say, in terms of what's that? And that's kind of given me an opportunity, I think, to dig into what like theories of, in a way, like theories of change more than anything else. And what was like, I was just going to read out the actual numbers. Let me just get the right page. Yeah. So you've got this that upon exiting the headset, absolute stigma consciousness metrics increase along all cohorts. And what I think is interesting about that is it's also kind of tallies with a few studies that have been done that look specifically about the effect of inhabiting a black body as a white person. And I'm sure you're aware of this. It's a Mel Slater study where there is a spike in stigma, and he also kind of unpacks that to think about the negative association by giving somebody an experience that's negative whilst they're in a racialized context, that it kind of leaves this particular negative kind of mark on that experience. And what kind of ends up happening, I think, in that moment is I think what impulse does, and it does it intentionally, is it shows. And definitely there have been people who've contacted us and said that you've gone too far, which is why it says, it's about extreme cases of ADHD, but it shows kind of how debilitating ADHD can be for someone's life, which is at odds with some language around, it's oh, I'm always late, or I'm a bit scatty, or that kind of thing. Like, what does it, when it's in a particular social context, does it really do? And so there's this kind of interesting way of understanding why you have that paradox of the stigma increasing at that point and then changing, after 4 weeks. And, Sara Ahmed, who's a theorist who kind of looks into feminist theories, talks about the feminist killjoy, the person who kind of ruins everyone's fun by pointing out that this is a misogynist experience or whatever. And she talks about a kind of discomfort that is necessary for change to happen. And what it feels like in both of the Mel Slater study and this study is that there is a discomfort in seeing the extent to which ADHD affects people's lives and puts them at odds with what their expectations of like a correct life lived properly should be. And so that's kind of, it feels like it's interesting in thinking of an increase of negative association being related, because you can then see that that increase in stigma doesn't impact positive behavioral change taking place, right? It's still a productive negativity or a productive discomfort. And so you've got this, what feels like, oh, this is a blip. Let's not talk about this data point too much because it looks wrong. But perhaps if you kind of look into it a bit more and you think about how you've maybe like eased somebody into a situation which they wouldn't have voluntarily been in, and that's obviously what experience design can be, just kind of like a low-level experiment at a different life experience, and that is kind of rupture. Or it's a particular kind of awareness of what that stigma was that they didn't realize they had. So a lot of people can just say, no, I'm fine with that stuff. Like all of those things. Yeah, no, I don't have any biases. And I think that if we reflect kind of personally on when we've become aware of our biases in our own lives, they usually come through close interaction or encounters. I guess I wasn't until I went to China that I realized the assumptions I held about China without ever having articulated them, right? So there becomes this realization as well of that stigma, and an honest, and perhaps it's not like an honesty versus a dishonesty, but there's a kind of invisibility in just thinking, well, this is just bad behavior. We're all on the same page. This is just, they're just not toeing the line. But what does it mean that like a 25% of men in the UK have, have been shown to have undiagnosed ADHD? What does that mean about the relationship between bad behavior and ADHD? Does it show that the lack of awareness of what is needed has caused that? Or, what's that connection? It's a confusing connection, but it kind of brings that stuff to light in the experience.
Yeah, just a follow-on question, because I have lots of my own phenomenological experiential data points for changes I've gone through and how I can orient myself to that. And I have other deeper philosophical thoughts around the theory of change, but I don't get a good sense of where this number is coming from stigma. Is this like a standardized survey, or how do you quantify the stigma?
Yeah, okay. So each group, the stigma questions varied depending whether it was self-stigma, i.e. somebody with ADHD. And so the kinds of questions that you see in that section are things like, I feel guilty about having ADHD. I think it's risky to tell others I have ADHD. I work hard to keep my ADHD a secret. I don't think I'm a good person. I feel damaged. All of that stuff. So it's like association of negativity with that. And then there are other kinds of questions, which, like, you know, we're talking about, I feel stigma from others. So alongside this report, there is like the full 121 pages of all the different questions that were asked the three different groups in the pre, post, and 1 month later. And so, you know, the kind of stuff around stigma from others, I think people think that those with ADHD cannot control their impulses and may behave unpredictably. Some people believe that individuals with ADHD are more aggressive, violent, or likely to get into trouble. Workplaces and schools should make changes to support people with ADHD. It's kind of like, what are the beliefs that are out there that are negative, you know? So that's what I'm saying. So there is this awareness of an association of negativity in ADHD, which happens once you've engaged with that world.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Just as I mean, it's very curious that those numbers went up. It's my take on it is that, like, there's a bit of things that may be like in the unconscious. And then as you bring it into the conscious awareness, then people may have more awareness of how they may feel more guilty, or they may have more ability to associate things attributed to ADHD that they can see that as behaviors that annoy them. Or when I think about this idea of friction, which is a big theme that came up in the IFA DocLab report, which was just this idea that technology is trying to create this frictionless world, and that part of being human and dealing with each other is that we actually encounter different aspects of friction. And friction is actually like a very productive thing that can create tension that can then, you know, for Jung, he talks about, you know, holding the tensions of the opposites until the reconciling third comes. And so sometimes you have to like butt your head up against this opposition conflict, a polarity point, before you can have some sort of like mediating factor, which is usually a third perspective that allows you to have some grace around something that, you know, you may not have before. So it may just be a natural process of change and transformation, is that like transformation is never like frictionless. It always has some degree of friction because there's always a transcend and include process from, you know, as Ken Wilber says, you have to transcend limitations of a certain perspective and include the other things that are after that. And there's also Kuhnian paradigm shifts that also are like this shift between like from one phase to the next phase, where there's a standard model, you have some anomaly, that anomaly is rejected, you don't acknowledge it. Then once you accept that anomaly, then you have to sit in that tension of the of those opposites, where you don't have the new paradigm that allows you to actually go through that new paradigm that allows you to kind of integrate everything and account for all that existing evidence. And so that process of paradigm shift within itself has a whole phase called model conflict, which means that you see the data, you acknowledge that it's real. Now what's the new paradigm that allows you to be in deeper relationship to it, which you have to account for the anomalous data, but also all that data that is there before. So I think that's just an inherent part of paradigm shifts and change and transformation, is that it's not frictionless. It's obviously going to have friction. And so I think the fact that the stigma numbers go up may just be pointing to that this is just a natural part of the evolutionary process.
And I think that's something that is written about a lot in cultural theory. Like, you know, so, and this isn't kind of a recent thing, you know, Stuart Hall talks about the necessary of like uncovering the invisible structures and the rupture that happens in that moment. And like I mentioned, Sara Ahmed talking about the necessary of the productive period of discomfort, friction, discomfort. And I think what's interesting is kind of what you were talking about in terms of like what exists at the pre-discursive level and what happens in pulling that into discursive level. So, you know, I've probably talked to you about this before, but, you know, so much of my interest in immersive came out of this visceral response I had to working in journalism and my frustration not being able to break apart language and get into the thing that it was sitting on. You know, you're kind of like polishing a turd or whatever the saying is. Your tools are so weak that, you know, whoever said the problem with words is you don't know whose mouth they've been in. You've got so much that I feel, you know, getting at that what Raymond Williams calls the structure of feeling, you know, the messy experience of a historical moment, which, as it feels like we have historical moments every few weeks now, like what's the emergent cultural atmosphere of now that like already exists before someone's going to find a name for it and say, oh, well, that was the noughties, or like, why was everybody wearing bell bottoms? And there's something about now that we can't talk about. And that's what I meant. Like, and these words, you know, we were asked at some point to make an experience for the refugee season at the Imperial War Museum. And it's like, we're not going to use that word. We're not going to make an experience about refugees. I've already just come to two, like, that's it's so loaded. Like, where can you go? How can I create an empty space from something if I'm already coming with all of this stuff? And, you know, you just spend entire time trying to unpick what somebody had walked into that room with already. And so there's something that's interesting, I think, in terms of what does it mean to show the stigma? But then what I think we should at least have a moment to go into is thinking about the kinds of behavioral change that happen and what's easy and what's less easy. Because what happens just straight after in all of the groups, you know, from this long list of options, and people also write things that they want to try and achieve, you know, a very large proportion, I think it's 78%, you know, want to change their relationship with the person in their family in some way, whether they're talking about, I think it's like 73% want to either have a conversation with a family member or change some of the processes that happen at home or with regards to the school or all of that stuff. And there's a much bigger gap between people's, I'm not trying to say they failed, but you know, there's this, not all the pathways between wanting to achieve something and achieving something are as easy as each other. So partly the probably the reason that it's easy and it's you've got this, I mean, there are a few things that you see kind of, well, I w intended to do that, and most people who intended to do it achieved it in regards to, say, like working within a clinical pathway. So you've got these grooves that already exist in the world that are, I'm not saying that they're negative that they exist, but it just means that there's lots of other processes in terms of change, this personal change, that may be harder to implement because there isn't some facilitation of that in some way. There isn't one small thing you could do, and then you're on a kind of merry-go-round of change. And so, even thinking about what this report reveals in terms of the barriers between, I really want to, I'm really inspired to, I really believe that I will, and I am going to, and why they can't. Now, obviously, that's called the real world and everything on earth. But there might just even be something in thinking about what does offboarding look like, you know, without having to give everybody a process that everybody has to implement. Like what I loved about the work that we were doing with Foster and Partners was that in an environment where there's a lot of organizations that like, what's the minimal requirement that I can do to say that I've like ticked this box of being a neurodiverse friendly environment? What was really interesting, and no doubt it's because Foster and Partners are a very creative firm in terms of architecture. They're globally renowned architects, brilliant, obsessive, wonderful people, creative geniuses, also destructive. You know, like there was probably a process that they could see was valuable, which is to allow people within the organization to design changes to the organization that would be accommodating. And so as a result of that, you know, quiet rooms or flexible working hours, you know, they came up with their own solutions. And that's what I'm, you know, I'm not saying that everybody has to do that, but I think there's a ownership of change. Like there's an ownership of what people can take into their lives that becomes easier if it's something that they already I have some ownership of having designed it, of having thought about it, of being supported to solve some of those problems in the moment of knowing that change is possible or it's worth thinking about.
Yeah, as I read through this report and hear you speaking and thinking about like this kind of theory of change, there's a lot of ways like coming up with a theory of the human experience of what's it mean to be a body that has desires and will and a mind and thinking and aspirations and imagination, but also like a body that takes action and puts things into habits, but also emotions. And so Aristotle had the ordering of the elements where he had at the bottom
which is the body, that has the least amount of degrees of freedom because it's like the solid phase of matter. And then on top of that, you have water, which is a little bit more fluid. And those are like more of the emotions and the feelings, and that you can't really control your emotions or feelings. They're also kind of faded. And so you have less agency. And so as you go up the stack, you have more degrees of freedom. And the next part of that is the air element, which is the mental and social presence. And so we're talking about mental health issues. And so these are all the different ways that we're looking at these different patterns of the way that we relate and make sense of the world. But also as you get up to the air element is about knowledge and learning and relating and being with other people. And then the highest level of degrees of freedom is the fire element. That's the desire and the will. You may have a desire and a will and aspiration, but you still have to have that ingression down and to have enough knowledge to then feel into the satisfaction and then finally kind of ingress it into your body and the habits that you're doing. And so there's a bit of a theory of change that's kind of embedded into this Aristotelian ordering of the elements, but also from a phenomenological lens, as I'm reading through your report, I'm seeing like having the patience would be like more of the earth. Like you have to have patience with other people and holding a safe space for them to have these habits. But then there's also the empathy and also the reflection of others' needs and being supportive and having awareness and support and seeking professional help. All of these are these more emotional vectors where you're actually empathizing and feeling in with people who have that. And those are both behaviors, but also people that are supporting them. And then the air element, are people seeking professional help? Are they gaining awareness? Are they seeking self-education or knowledge? Or are they talking to people? Are they relating? Are they having understanding? And then there's support, learn, share, talk about it, you know, seeing a doctor, avoiding labels. So quantifying other people. So that's kind of like the mental sphere. And the highest sphere, those are the most agency in terms of desires and will and aspirations and the habits that you are actually like your actions, your behaviors. Does this actually take root and have change? And those are the everything from accountability, habits, trying to avoid giving other people advice about what they should do. So that's another like caution around that, but also the different behavioral changes. So as I'm reading through your report, I'm sort of schematizing it around all of these different things that people could do, but each of those represent different vectors of change that they can do. They can either have a desire to change. They could seek information. They could actually be in deeper relationship with other people and emotionally relate to them and have empathy, or they could provide safe spaces and show some patience. So yeah, anyway, I don't know if you have any comments as I sort of schematize all the different ways that you're trying to get at these different ways of quantifying and measuring change.
I think it just doubles down a little bit on thinking about what, and you know, this is just what almost all of those reports say consistently, thinking about that offboarding. So obviously you've got this momentary tunnel, let's say, between your heavy, no degrees of freedom body and your virtual body, where you get a momentary kind of, I don't know, like black hole between two non-existent places, your ontological moment in the VR, where what usually happens, and you kind of alluded to it, is that although people are listening to the stories of these strangers, it kind of cuts across the memories of things that have happened. And this actually was a piece of advice given to myself and Amy, you know, almost in the first week that Anagram existed, by our mentor at Blast Theory, Jew, when she said, always leave space for the memories associations of the participants. So where in that can you evoke that moment so that it's not just, you know, whether or not they're giving empathy to themselves or to their partners or child or, you know, their former child or whoever it is, it's kind of happening at the same time. It's kind of a whatever you might call like a, yeah, like a magic object that is just a stand-in for something in your own life. And so there's something I think, and this is why I think it's so important that it's difficult because of the way that stuff gets made. But, you know, as with Goliath, I know we're going to be working with this project for a lot of many years and refining what that call to action is or how to facilitate a kind of smooth re-entry into the world where, like you said, or like it's Pierre Bourdieu, isn't it, like habitus and all of the things which just exist in the world that are kind of stuck. How do you give somebody a playful way of tweaking with what feels like low friction. The way that Facebook used to, if you wanted to pull down a photograph that somebody had tagged you in, they used to like pre-write your message to them because they knew that people, they didn't want to spend all of their staff time like into, you know, sorting out the fact that somebody got photographed in the office party. And so they would just say, well, you know, they'd just open the box and say, here's a message that's half pre-written about so to help you figure out how to tell this person you don't want to be tagged in this photo. So it's, you know, it's almost like using that kind of social psychology to help facilitate that difficult to begin task.
Yeah, from the process of seeing impulse playing with reality through the different iterations and reading through this report, I can sort of see that you're very driven by the story. And then I guess one question I have is, as you think about moving forward and think about what is typically called the impact campaign, where, you know, there's a bit of how you created the experience and now you're thinking about that. I imagine like in the future, that may be like more of a seamless like path that may be integrated into the experience itself that is maybe giving people offboarding ways, or maybe you want to focus things on more of the story rather than the pedagogical, like then it becomes an educational thing rather than a storytelling thing. And so, but imagine that there's a lot of this guiding people towards in this impact campaign ways that they could either self-select into like, hey, do you think you might have ADHD? Here's some options for you to go check it out. Or, hey, do you have a friend and family that you know has that? Oh, here's a passion here. Do you want to hold space for them? Do you want to emotionally connect to them? Do you want to take action? Do you want to learn more? Or do you want to change your own habits? You know, those are different points where people could be set off to then go off and actually have support to bring about that change, or to have resources that are made available that may not be in the context of the experience, or maybe in the future it is more firmly, tightly coupled into the experience itself. So just curious to hear some of your thoughts on,
I don't think it needs to be, I don't think it needs to be inside the experience. I think the experience, there's a, I don't know what word it is, but there's a danger, right? I think just as we're allergic to AI, we're allergic to public service broadcasting, you know, and I think it's important. And I think people trust the voice that's in Impulse because it's not telling me what the right way to do things are. And it's really trying to just bring up a moment where your own reflections can help you see a path or see something without telling you this is the right thing to do. Now, obviously, because we did a study, we had to ask specific questions and, you know, but people came up with their own, like, this is what I want to do. Have you done it? Da, da, da. So we can't assume just because we're making a documentary, we're like the forces of good in the world. But on the same side, you know, we'd made this because there's actually an urgent public health crisis around ADHD, like genuinely, like I mentioned that 1 in 4 UK prisoners have ADHD, which is undiagnosed. And if you have ADHD, you're 5 times more likely to commit suicide, especially amongst women. And then I feel like we did think about, I'm not, the language of impact campaign sometimes doesn't quite resonate for me with this kind of medium, because what I think is the impact campaign is finding where it goes and what structure it exists under. And are you aware of the book Culture is Not an Industry?
No.
Because I think it's really about the history of culture in Britain and the kind of language around how in the 90s, probably related to New Labour, the Spice Girls, and this idea of we don't have an actual industry where we make things anymore. Culture is our industry. And the book Culture is Not an Industry looks into the consequences of this language around creative industries coming into existence, which is almost like, it almost bookends the fact that now there's this study around what's the impact, what's the change impact of a piece of art, and whether or not, as opposed to needing to justify its existence by showing statistical change amongst a population in a positive social way, that actually perhaps art is a kind of murky world through which ideas kind of come and we take what we need. And it's like this fertile ground for when we need new metaphors that we can't process what's happening at the same time. And things that, you know, in that murky lake of content, relevance and irrelevance is no longer really the paradigm by which we should judge success. because what's useful is used. And what's disliked or unfavorable is also useful because it has to be a place where change can emerge from. And change, if you, I know it's not a theory of change, but change by its nature is something that's not already in circulation. So where is the kind of black box of human thought that we can delve into and find something new and unexpected? So yes, why is there a study about how an artwork creates positive change along a pre-understood line of what positivity is? Yes, it's a little bit of a paradox, isn't it?
Indeed.
As so you know, we were very motivated with Goliath, which is around the treatment of people with psychosis, and really through working with that community, it became very clear that they wanted to address how they were treated in the health system. And through kind of following that investigation, we found a huge amount of honesty within public healthcare in the UK around compassion fatigue and how stigma against mental health conditions means that the way people may be treated. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's going on that just means that taking Goliath to the particular context was relevant. And so, you know, we did think a lot about prisons and we thought, of course, about suicide. But I think the other data point, which kind of led us to look for this kind of more like what does ADHD accommodations look like in the workplace, is around the likelihood of people with ADHD to lose their job or be fired or impulsively quit. And it felt that actually some of that impact campaign is already in development, just working with organizations that are at the right kind of scale, you know, not the 50,000 employees that can't do something that's a bit more hands-on, that are really looking for like a drop-down menu on a website, but the organizations at a particular scale, which particularly perhaps understand their connection with neurodiversity within their workplace and are looking to understand how to improve people's lives, basically. You know, work is such a huge part of our lives. And yes, schools are a minefield for kids with ADHD, but genuinely, you know, I'd love to work with teachers on impulse and kind of use that as a way of exploring what kind of processes are taking place within schools. But I would say that, like, the work environment is a little bit more easy as a kind of context to try and get into that system. We did some work with Games for Change in New York, where they've actually designed some brilliant, like, curriculum tools that go along with Impulse. But we're still in the process of working out how and who we're working with on those kinds of resources. And so, if you're interested, get in touch. You know, it's not so much that I think the impact campaign can kind of launch the moment that an experience like this comes into being, because it's not like the moment everything has a release globally in cinemas. It takes longer. The long tail is much longer, much deeper, but it takes a bit more handholding.
No, I think the framework that Pine provides in his transformation economy was sort of preparing people before they go in the experience. That's what we typically call onboarding. You have the actual experience, and then the offboarding that we typically call, he calls like reflecting. So you're reflecting on the experience, and then there's like a follow-up stage that happens after the experience, because his model for change and transformation is that it's actually like a process that takes time. So there's like check-in points that happen after that point, after you have the experience. And so there's a bit of, I think VR experiences are already kind of doing the onboarding, offboarding, but I think there's a bit of like, how do you steer people towards the impact campaign that comes after the experience, where the experience is really focusing on the emotion and using the affordances of the immersion and all these agency and all this kind of like unique affordances of all the different qualities of presence that are coming together to make a real impact people in the moment, to then potentially want to follow up in whatever that may be afterwards with different ramps that may be. How do you want to still engage with this material? How do you want to either learn more information, be in deeper relationship to the people that you know? Are there ways that you want to change your own habits? Do you have your own aspirations? Do you have your own vision of how like doing something like getting diagnosis may help you with your own human flourishing? So there's, I think, this kind of models for change sit into that part that happens after the experience with that kind of follow on in that both the reflection part that can start kind of like, okay, now we're going to provide an opportunity for maybe in the moment to reflect on what you just did. But for Pine's model, that's like, okay, that's a memorable experience. If you stop there, in order to really have change and impact, you have to like do something after that. What's the call to action? What happens after that? Which I think is you know, what AGOG is all about in terms of why they're interested in funding these types of things, because they really want to get to the root of, yes, they can clearly see that this is powerful and transformative, but how do you take it to the next level of either providing enough evidence that there is measurable change of some sorts, but also just like frameworks and models. I see a lot of what this report is doing is starting to map out these different behaviors, experiences, relationships, knowledge, emotions, space, patience, embodiment, these different things that are happening that you're kind of quantifying in a different way throughout your report, that's starting to at least have a first cut of a schema of trying to identify all the different qualities of that change afterwards.
Yeah. So, and I think if it, once you kind of drill into the context, I think that long-term relationship is really possible. So the version where you're working with teachers with impulse, or you're working with individuals who are part of the criminal justice system, it's also almost like, you know, breaking down those groups, because, you know, within, even when you look at impact campaign processes, you're saying, well, is this person a policy decider? What can they do? You know, so it's being a little bit more granular in terms of what is possible for an individual to do within their own context. And obviously with ADHD, it's really interesting because it's so pervasive in terms of the context in that it will appear, from like school to work to relationships to childcare to all of that stuff. It's in our lives. And so it's a really interesting model to develop with people who are already working in the field. So I'd love that to happen, to get into the grain, you know, because as the creators of the experience, we can't necessarily bring it all the way to its conclusion alone. Like, that's not something we can achieve without real partners.
Yeah. And in my experiential design framework, I have quality, context, character, and story. So the qualities of presence we've talked about, the context are all those contextual domains that you just listed there. So self, other, home, work, you know, but also friends, family, friendships, prisons, education, schools, so many different contextual domains. But yeah, identifying what those contextual domains are. But I guess as we start to, you know, I know it's late for you in the middle of the night, I'm just curious if there's other things you wanted to really dig into, or things that you wanted to chat with me about in terms of this report that's coming out, things that we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah, good point. I mean, as you were talking, obviously, I just get led wherever you take me, which is also great in its own way. Just a small detail, I guess. And I don't know if we've already covered it. So if we've covered it, don't worry. While you were talking, in 2005, 21 years ago or so, when I was working in my early days as a researcher in television, I actually was thinking about this because I worked on a series for Channel 5, which was quite a tacky channel back in those days in England. And it was a series called Big Ideas That Changed the World. And it was about something that kind of came into existence that didn't exist before, and whether that was the environmental movement, or Desmond Tutu did Christianity and Mikhail Gorbachev did communism. And, you know, I think there's a challenge and a trap that what you've talked about, I guess we should just verbalize to make sure that we know that we're not trying to do that, is not to give individuals the responsibility to fix everything. So there's something that kind of happens within the hearts and minds, as you were talking about, like the fire versus the water and all of the other aspects. And then what happens between people, between communities, is that there's something I think that might be missing there that we didn't necessarily lean into, about how to strengthen some of the kind of isolationist tendencies that our kind of civic society are put under, that is also somehow related to how culture performs in our communities right now, and what culture looks like and feels like. And where, you know, I've really enjoyed touring with Impulse, because the kind of the audience participation in talks and debates has been so like raw and alive, because there's something in the subject that people haven't connected with each other about, or haven't felt like they're allowed to talk about. And, you know, it's kind of messy, and it's not PR content, and it's not going to work very well on Instagram, and nobody wants to get cancelled. But there's something about the rub in terms of, well, what is okay for me to experience, and how can we work out a way through care and understanding? And that moment of just, you know, I know we kind of dismiss it as like, oh, it's an emotional heightened moment, what happens after that? But I do think that's an opening that facilitates a kind of birth. And then, so just listening to you talk, I just think, okay, well, what about, yeah, like what about community and what about the structures that can help something feel like not just the responsibility of that individual?
Yeah, I know Will Hall is one of the authors of Harm Reduction Guide, and he's got a podcast about mental health. And so he's pointed to how in some Scandinavian cultures, how they treat mental health as more of a cultural issue rather than something that is blamed on the individual. So you have more relational approaches for how you deal with issues. So because I think there may be some of these issues that are not necessarily like, oh, I have ADHD. It's like, well, the whole society and culture that's being bombarded by you is like encouraging you to develop these different types of ADHD habits. And so there's a bit of looking at this systemically, aside from just an individual, but also just the larger ecosystem. And I did want to read off on this section 15, a number of these different things that I think are getting to, like, how can you support and be in relationship to people with ADHD? This was sort of like, I guess, part of the qualitative aspect of the research where you're asking open-ended questions in terms of brainstorming different ways to be in deeper relationship with people with ADHD. And I think it's important just to kind of read through this list and have any comments that you have. So encourage healthy habits and alternatives, creating accountability and support systems, advocate for better services, promote understanding at work, learn about ADHD, share helpful resources, provide a safe space to talk openly about ADHD, respect boundaries around advice, avoid assuming or labeling, and support through awareness and empathy. So I think each of these are kind of pointing towards that thing that you're speaking about in terms of like, how can you actually be in deeper relationship with people with ADHD? And these were just some of the different themes that came up in terms of people that were just brainstorming on their own, different ways that they could perhaps support people with ADHD. So I don't know if you have any other comments on this list or this ways to actually foster and cultivate that relationality.
Yeah, I think that particular list. So there's also a section where people wrote their own suggestions of what they did, and people went into various levels of specifics. And that's where some of that detail around supporting a family member with a morning routine or just trying to put structures in that averted some of the crisis situations that, you know, were written about in detail. And there's something I think quite, you know, because obviously a report like this or the study in itself is also an intervention, right? So you don't normally sit down after an experience and say, well, what are the things I'm going to change in my life? And it could be that that in itself is of a quality that kind of drives some of that home. So as we tour Impulse, there's always been a reflection room. So when you come out of the experience, you know, not in the South by preview, but there's a room that's full of different people's comments as well as newspaper articles and just a lot of different material. And there's something, it's a place for people to express. And that's, it's, you know, it has to be a place where it's kind of a low barrier to entry. And I think that even if you don't have that report asking you or the study that's asking you to do that, you also found that kind of quality in the comments that people would write in that room. And that being the area, like, you know, it was around personal guilt or a sense of blame or how they'd seen themselves in their lives, which really connects to that issue around, you know, the relationship with suicide attempts and ADHD, as well as thinking about partners and family members who were suffering in a way that they hadn't really appreciated. So there's a degree where I think, yeah, I like imagining that putting the tools of thinking about what change means in the hands of the audience, as opposed to telling them what change is necessary. Because I think this is where, like, creating a sense that there is an expert answer, that there is a pre-existing pathway for mental health support, and it isn't inviting you to be creative and instinctual as a human, doing that kind of undercuts the artwork. No, it's your feelings and your response and that process that has to be the melting pot, at which point the furnace in which the kind of iron is cast, or like the transformation happens, and that's kind of yours. And you don't, you know, I've never really, you know, often in the past, I haven't really wanted people to write a comment wall in that way because I've just thought, well, you know, keep it. It's yours. Like, I don't need to know. I don't need validation as a creator of something. I'm not looking for confirmation. But there is something in the act of writing that which is still yours. It's you doing it is something. And if nobody ever sees it, it's something. So there's something kind of profound anyway in imagining or being invited to think about change. Because who even asks us ever?
I think that's a great point in terms of the being asked to imagine possible futures is within itself a transformative potential, because in Whitehead's process philosophy, you have the mental pole to physical pole, and it's a process going from one to the other. So you have the speculative realm of the archetypal potentialities of what's possible, and then that ingresses into reality, into what's actual. And so it's actually embodied. So you go from the mind to the body, but you also have your will that's kind of like driving it, your creativity, your desires, your agency, your aspirations. And it's all being synthesized through your emotions. And so it's kind of like anticipating the future of those possibilities, integrating the past of all those existing habits. And then through that concrescence of all that stuff coming together, kind of synthesized through your emotions, you're kind of like melding it all together. So it's a bit of a Whiteheadian process philosophy, provides me a bit of a framework for understanding this ingression of possible space. You know, you can talk about it, that's a mind, that's the mental space, but to actually embody it, that's like ingressing the mental into the physical. So you're embodying those actions and creating those habits, and those habits have to be sustained over time in order to actually have behavioral change. And to have like true transformation is like defined by the way that you act. And also your identity, how you identify, is also a thing that Pine is at. He says that all transformational change is identity change. So that I am this and now I am that. So you're basically going from one to the other, whatever those ways that you identify from one thing to the other is another way of describing what transformation is. So,
Oh, that's in itself, it's quite interesting. I think, you know, just like the report, the study kind of divided the two different spheres of empathy, the cognitive and the affective. And then it also, you know, I said I'd kind of like end in knowledge, but this kind of general knowledge versus knowledge that you can have through the somatic experience is also kind of divided. So just to explain, you know, so what we're really trying to understand is what makes behavioral change happen. If somebody has increased knowledge in the general knowledge, let's say factual knowledge because of the experience, does that lead to change? If they have this visceral insight that's kind of embedded within the experience or the cognitive load experience or that kind of thing that you get given because it's a mixed reality experience and not because it's a piece of paper, how does that correlate? So that's why I meant, like, I think the data, it could even, you know, it's something that I'd love to see people build on because those categories, they're probably crude in their own way. You know, even you're just, you know, it's you could kind of almost try and break that into the categories that you're just talking about, right? So which what are the different kinds of ways in which we receive things in order to feel like they're ours? And this idea of like it's an identity change. I guess I've been thinking often about this. You know, this claim that, you know, VR enters something with it, which is referred to as the autobiographical memory. I think about, or I try to think about the values that I hold. And although probably those individual experiences that drove to those values are no longer in my conscious mind, sometimes they do appear, you know, those kind of little incidents that surprised you between the ages of 5 and 15 that you can correlate between why you have lived your life by these rules. And so I'm interested in, I don't think we have to go around manufacturing those experiences for people. Like, people are alive and they interact with people. And obviously, because identity is such a play now for consumerism, it's kind of it's vulnerable to just becoming so two-dimensional. And but it's also where we build our genuine sense of who we are and what we can perform in the world. So there's a necessity to kind of, even though it feels like, oh God, why are we doing this in such a, you know, a scientific way? Are we the ad agency that are trying to psychometric people? It's like, well, we kind of have to bring identity back into kind of just you know, beyond if you believe this, you might wear these pair of trainers. You know, so we've kind of sold off some of these bits and bobs to the highest bidder. And how do we reclaim it so that cultural experience isn't always also an identity play, and that the idea of identity transformation is, you know, that I remember the piece that we did for like the first year of the war in Syria. I swear to tell the truth. I don't know if you experienced that, but
no,
we did a really deep dive. I mean, I think it was of a time, because now I feel like this idea of people being in a bubble, what do you call it? Like a news bubble or whatever,
a
was
filter
kind
bubble.
of, yeah. The idea that there was a very divided way of seeing the conflict in Syria. And it was kind of where a lot of this kind of new stuff around bots and Russian bots and who was playing off which meta narrative over who. And, you know, is the fact that everyone thought, oh, it's a bit complicated, actually a kind of strategy? And so, you know, the piece was done because, you know, it was around Syria and it was called I Swear to Tell the Truth. And it was about our ideological discomfort with stories that don't fit our narrative. And what does that discomfort mean? Why, when you switch off recommendations on whatever platform, does it feel like you're suddenly in a cold world where nobody knows you and you don't belong? So, you know, when you get down to the kind of texture of how we act and who we believe we are, we're kind of in that realm of a culture where interacting with people who don't abide by the same paradigms that we implicitly have is a stressful and a scary experience for many people. So, I mean, this is just the thin end of the wedge, but like, obviously I really believe that the ADHD narrative is important, but I also think I'm also just trying to get at how we change our minds about the things we have in the world that we think are true. Like, how do we actually change our minds? But yeah, I do think that stuff around dealing with that kind of cognitive dissonance. And I know that when I was younger, I remember witnessing as a teenager the war in Yugoslavia, and I did have a fascination in how civil war begins. You know, how does that happen? And during the revolution in Egypt, I was making a couple of films there, and it became really obvious to me that the role that the media plays in making that moment possible. And, you know, I know that in theory, it's nothing new to say that that's where those moments begin. But it gave me, like, I don't know, I obviously understood somehow, there's some memory I have in my life that made me think that storytelling was important. And that's my like own autobiographical reason why this is my value system. But living in Egypt during the year of the revolution and seeing how close the country came to civil war, you know, obviously, you know, people live in that moment in different ways. You know, you're in America, I'm sure you can see how that happens, but the power of telling those stories differently suddenly feels more urgent than ever.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think this is a really bold aggregation of a lot of the stuff that's still kind of like emerging and developing. I think as we move forward, we'll have more and more sophisticated frameworks to continue to kind of specify and measure and direct people towards this change. I mean, understanding the nature of change and transformation, it's a lifelong journey for me, but my own personal evolution and transformation and trying to do that in my own life. And so I think that's, as Joe Pine has identified, that's sort of like the next economic offering after the experience economy, is that people are searching for this type of deeply meaningful, life-changing, transformative, enabling aspirations, enabling human flourishing, this type of media that is allowing this type of change to identify issues around mental health or these different crises that we have in our culture, and to provide some sort of media that people can have an experience and to be able to relate to it in a way and to deepen their relationship to it, to take action afterwards, to gain more knowledge of understanding, to relate to communities, to their family members in different ways, to create spaces and contexts for them to relate to each other, and also to just, you know, feel empathy and relationality of that and understanding. So I think that, you know, what you're doing is starting to map that out here in this report. And so it's really exciting to see that work that's being done. So I guess the final question is, what do you think the ultimate potential of all this XR immersive storytelling, you know, all these kind of technologically mediated experiential design and immersive stories, you know, what's the potential of why you do what you do and what it might be able to enable and bringing about change in the world?
I mean, I think that the opportunity that I see there's all of the stuff around semantics that kind of cuts through the invisible politics of language and the stuff that's so sticky and difficult, and felt experience and felt realities. And, you know, I feel so strongly that so much of the media I consume, I do basically with my body in the freezer, you know, like kind of switched off, totally static, kind of going into my head and never kind of oozing into anything else. And, you know, I don't know what the theory is around that, but there's something about being real and being me and being myself and being vulnerable and being actually there that is exposing and uncomfortable, and I'm not used to it anymore. And my nieces and nephews that are 10 years younger than me hate the idea of actually having to be anywhere or do anything or to talk to a real person. So there's something I think over time that is about entering felt experience. I don't think it's necessarily new. I just think that our access to it has been kind of cut off in many ways, and it's kind of like a gorgeous, playful world. And then I also think I have some fears and challenges about the institutions that are built around this creative industry and what that means and who it serves and who it doesn't serve and the politics of it. And that's kind of the I was referencing, I think it's Justin somebody. So there's an opportunity there, which is just about where that culture goes, you know, and there's something, you know, the richness of an experience like Goliath, it's so vast. It's just in a headset. It's like a tiny little headset, but it's like you've built a set. It's like you've built a world. It's a sound. It's like, it's so phenomenal, like 5D. And you can take it to like a community center in a mental health clinic and somebody is having like a premium cultural experience, and they don't have to take a train down and go to the opera and feel all of the identity clashes that comes with how culture is curated. So that for me is still the most exciting thing about the medium. It's the way it kind of shows up in the wrong places, even though everyone's trying to standardize it. I love the fact that it's beguiling to standardization.
Brilliant. And is there anything else that's left unsaid that you like to say to the broader immersive community?
I'm really proud of the report. I think there's so much to get excited about. And I think it should be serving everybody in how it talks about the texture and the reality of how people process what they're thinking, what they're feeling, and also what they're doing. And so, you know, use it and play with it, and thank Agog for funding it, because getting the stuff actually into reality is, as we all know, its own challenge, and just making sure that actually the right thing got funded, and it's super rigorous and it's an incredible piece of work, and I'm excited about people building on it.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, May. It's really exciting to see that Anagram is collaborating on reports like this, because honestly, when I've dug into the academia and like IEEE conference, there's a lot of, let's say, experiences with programmer art that doesn't necessarily like what I would see at the frontiers of immersive storytelling that I think is really pushing forward the medium of where it can go. And so it's exciting to see that what I see is like premier top tier contents being used in an academic context to start to think about how this also is connected to these issues that are very real, and how can we start to create these frameworks to help people become in deeper relationship to that and to undergo transformative processes, whatever that may look like, and start to quantify that in different ways. And so I think it's going to really help to shape that impact campaign after these experiences. I do think that there's going to be a continued development of these immersive experiences that just are driven by the artistic impulse. And that afterwards, it's like, okay, now what? Now, how do we actually ground this into physical reality in a way that it actually can bring about change in the world? And I think that's a lot of what this is starting to kind of lay out, at least some of the sketches of the types of things that people may be doing in terms of learning, relating, or changing behaviors, or being in a relationship and feeling, or, you know, creating safe spaces for people. So yeah, thanks again for all the work that you're doing and for coming on the podcast to help break it all down.
Fantastic. Thank you for meeting me in the middle of the night.
For sure.
So that was May Abdallah of Anagram, and she's one of the co-directors of Impulse, Playing with Reality, which won the top prize, Venice Immersive 2024. And there was just a brand new report that came out this past week on May 28th, 2026. It's called Results of Impact Study Carried Out for Mixed Reality Experience Impulse. And there's a digest for general public. There's also a Impulse Research Study Detail and Results by Alexandra Sierra. Both of them actually are authored by Alexandra Sierra. And May was not involved directly in the writing of this report, but she was providing some feedback as to what their intentions were in creating this experience. So I have a number of different takeaways about this interview is that, first of all, well, it's just really interesting to hear from an artist's perspective, what's it mean to start to have your work quantified in these different ways. And there's this book that May pointed to, which is Culture is Not an Industry, which is trying to, I guess, in some ways push back against this trying to quantify and justify the existence of art. As an artist, she's just creating art for art's sake. But there's this larger ecosystem for funders and folks like Agog. They're trying to get a sense of how do you start to quantify different aspects of the impact. So one of the things that I found really interesting in just talking to May was that just kind of the speculation of perhaps part of the research study itself is creating a structure for people to be prepared for the experience, what they're coming into. Then they see the experience and they have another opportunity to talk about it immediately afterwards. And then a month later, they check in with them to see like what happens, did they have any behavioral change? And they know that they're going to be on the hook for having another conversation about it. And so in some ways, just the structure of this research itself could be a part of this transformational framework for people to more fully contextualize the preparation of coming in to see it, to actually see it, and then afterwards kind of reflect on that again. This is a framework from Joseph Pine where he calls it encapsulation rather than sort of the onboarding and offboarding. There's preparation and then you see the experience and then there's a bit of a reflection afterwards, which is sort of like this offboarding process that I think actually does sound like as Impulse Playing with Reality was screening, they would have a more explicit like reflection room for people to either document or have the space to digest what they just went through. Whether or not you're in one of these different cohorts of, at least you're not consciously aware of anybody that you know that has ADHD, you probably do. They're not always maybe disclosing or maybe people are not always aware. But then there's that next level of people that know that they have friends and family with ADHD. And then there's the final one where either you think you have ADHD or you suspect that you might, because getting a diagnosis is a whole process within its own right. So there's these different cohorts and they're trying to like quantify different ways of did they learn more information, but ultimately they're looking at this behavioral change. And I think that was, for me, one of the more interesting aspects was to see all the different ways that people were being in tighter relationship with people that they knew with ADHD and reaching out to them, offering support, suggesting ways they can reach out or get more help in different ways. So kind of empathizing with that condition. And then from there, different ways of seeking more knowledge. And then also, like, are there other habits that they're going to start to change, like behaviors of going in to see a doctor, as an example, was I think over half the people that end up suspecting that they might have it, then having a follow-up with a doctor afterwards. And so stuff like that where you can start to see the different behavioral changes that are happening. And I think through the qualitative intake form, there's a series of different things that people were doing. And in my keynote, I'll be diving into a little bit more. I start to schematize and categorize those into different aspects of empathy and emotional vector. There's the holding the space and being patient, but there's also the information and the knowledge and being in tighter relationship. I think that's like the core where most of the different behaviors are coming. And then finally, there's like the behaviors and the change of actually taking action afterwards. And so I think when thinking about immersive impact, there's like this theory of change of like, how do you bring about change? And for Agog, they have this whole open call for climate futures and immersive impact. So they're asking people to submit proposals that are going to give anywhere from like $25,000 to $200,000. And the deadline for that is coming up here on June 12th. And so definitely go submit something if you have some ideas where you're looking at specifically climate change and XR immersive experiences in some fashion. But as Agog was presenting about this, they had a slide in VRChat in one of their sessions that said climate communication can often feel technical, abstract, or overwhelming. Immersive media creates emotional proximity, embodiment, and connection. And so there's this way in which that folks at Agog can feel that there are limits to just knowing things abstractly. And there's a bit of like this kind of heliocentric view from nowhere type of information. But when you put it into your body and you make it personal and it's more phenomenological and experiential, and you can feel it in your bones, in your emotions, and the relational dynamics of that, but also be able to participate and play, there's ways that, you know, actually engages people on a much deeper level. And they've had from their own experiences that they've seen that they have been moved and impacted by these different types of experiences. And so just trying to create these broader frameworks and ideas for how to start to understand that is something that AGOG is really interested in funding. And you kind of have to have your own theory of change for thinking about how you would use XR and immersive experiences to start to bring about larger change at a societal level, the policy level, or changing consumer behaviors in a way that is going to actually bring about change. And so this climate futures and immersive media open call for AGOG is, you know, really interested in exploring that in more detail. And in my keynote that I gave at Meaningful XR, I sort of give some of my own phenomenological framework as well as some of my own theories of change as I'm thinking about all these different questions. Also, check out the IFA Doc Lab R&D Summit report that starts to dig into some of these other frameworks from like Joseph Pine and the transformation economy, or Mariana Mazzucato and the mission-oriented approach that she has. She has got the Common Good Economy book that's actually also coming out here this week on June 4th. And then also Kat Cizak and William Mercurio talking about co-creation and, you know, this idea of media fragments being able to facilitate different community development processes. And also there is this more extended and detailed version of the report where it goes into more of the questions and the full context for the different types of questions that each of these different cohorts were being asked. And so you can go to their website, which is weareanagram.co.uk/impulse. That's where you can either get the full study context and details, or you can take a look at downloading the version that has summarized for the general public. So that's all I have for today. And I just want to thank you for listening to the Voices of VR podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, then please do spread the word, tell your friends, and consider becoming a member of the Patreon. This is a listener-supported podcast, and so I do rely upon donations from people like yourself in order to continue to bring you this coverage. So you can become a member and donate today at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.